Listen up, Umi. This is a podcast with the most ducker. This is Forge the Narrative.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host, BL, about All Souls Podcast. I'm joined today by Red Powell.
What up?
Tanya Gates.
Hey, everybody.
And Adam Camilleri.
G'day.
Welcome, everyone, to the show. Got all kinds of stuff to talk about this week. Doing some list building. I played a couple of games into Death Guard. I painted some Death Guard. Got a tournament coming up. Somebody needs to borrow some models. They're like, yo, do you have a couple of blow drones with grenades? Because they're very good right now. They're very good. They're extreme. Cannot stress how good they are for what they do. Now, they're just like a floating gunboat, but they put out a lot of damage and they add even more like offensive power from the Death Guard. So they're very good. You're going to see them out there. And that's what I played into. I played a couple of games into Death Guard this past weekend. And want to talk about some of the things I'm messing around with my list as well. Two things.
Nice.
How are y'all doing?
Well, I'm doing okay. I am also just trying to put together a list. I got all my cards out and I'm trying to figure out like what I can do because I'm kind of in between events right now with no painting projects, which never happens. So if I was going to make any changes to my list, like now is the time to do it because I've got time to paint stuff. So that's all I've been working on.
Nice. I'm up to my eyeballs in basing knights. I've got 15 knight chassis on my painting desk, and I'm just doing all the bases at once. I got a bunch of molding clay. I bought the wrong one of the air dry molding clay, and I'm doing it to build up the bases, put some craters in and stuff like that. Because, of course, I built all the legs in weird ways, and now I need to get the legs and build up bits and pieces of the base to match the legs. No tactical rocks.
Oh, the different heights of legs or whatever?
I got you, Tanya. I'm reading your brain. Zero tactical rocks. I'm building up like the whole base. So it's at a level. Sorry, what'd you say, Paul?
I just said different heights of the feet and stuff.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, because I bent a bunch of knees, moved around a bunch of ankles, stuff like that. I'm just absolutely up to my balls in that. Should be done in about a week's time the basing material, so the detailed basing material for my knights is another knight. It's a knight that I've had for like a couple of years, and I've just been breaking bits off it and sticking it on bases. Like one armiger is standing next to a whole leg of Imperial Knight. It's just the same height as the armiger, and I was like, it's cool.
That does sound cool. Let's see what I was doing. I have a Ballista's Dreadnought in my Blood Angel list. I think I've talked about this before. It's basically kind of to deny... bring it down if necessary. Like, you know, if it's somewhere in the back, you might not get it. Might be some safe points for a turn. And I think that in an event where you're playing where the points are scored on a differential, you know, there are some things like point denial and even like the challenger mechanic that I think may make is a bigger element of play when you're not playing just like straight battle point.
How
off base am I potentially with that?
You're not. I mean, I don't like you paying 140 points for it, for the privilege of a little bit of points denial. But I think the theory is sound, absolutely sound. I wish there was a cheaper way to do it for Marines, where you could just take like, you know, like a Custodians can take a Palace Grab Tank, which is just a little buzz box that has one okay gun and has a good save for its points and can kind of just go sit in an expansion objective and then I bring it down, for example. And there are other armies like, you know, say, take a single Sagittari in your Votan. I mean, Guard don't really get the privilege, but then Guard can take like a single unit of 20 guys to deny a Cull and kind of just be like, sit that thing on the back and that holds down the home with like Leontis or a Command Squad joint. And that's totally fine too. So yeah, I really am all about doing things to, you know, mess with your opponent's ease of play, so to speak.
Well, the ATV is not a vehicle. Like, it doesn't...
Unfortunately.
It doesn't count. Yeah. And then I started thinking about, like, oh, let me look at a Whirlwind. I haven't looked in a Whirlwind in a little while. Like, the gun on a Whirlwind is actually not that bad, but then it's like 180 points? Are you kidding?
Pay for that artillery, man.
Yeah.
What in the hit on fours is this, you know?
Like, well, yeah. At some point, I think approximately about 9 months ago, Jude, I was like, does it shoot indirect? Yes.
Yeah.
If you tick this box, it must be 180 points plus to pretty much roll. But yeah, I'm just having to think, what's the cheapest vehicle the Marines have access to?
So there's a land speeder that is, I think, might be the cheapest. Like one of the one that has the auto cannons that let you reroll or plus one AP for shooting or something like that. Or
Either the Hailstrike.
I might be Hailstorm something or whatever. speeder, I think, might be the cheapest.
I just like died a little bit inside when you said that tank was 140 points and then you said it was too expensive.
I know.
So space marine of you. I know. So space marine.
It's too expensive for a piece to just sit on the backboard, but it's still a quality piece, right?
So I guess rhinos is also, of course, cheaper than that. But I mean, like, you need the conditions to take a rhino, and I don't satisfy.
Well, exactly right. If you've got to put a unit inside it, it's already blowing out the cost. And if you haven't got a premium unit, it is blowing out. I mean, a single impulsor ain't a bad call, especially if you're taking something like, you know, five assault intercessors.
Got Blade Guards. The Blade Guard veterans.
100%. Yeah. You just use that to deliver those dudes, go run off, sit on the backfield. What's a Razorback cost these days? 95? Nah, you do the impulsive Razorback. What about this one? Land Raider Redeemer. Oh, this fresh new hot take. Oh, geez, what's this thing do? 285 points.
It might tip balance the points. But so with the Ballistus Dreadnought, if you're shooting at something that's below starting strength, you know, or half strength, then you get the, you know, basically the rerolls by itself. But the Predator Annihilator, it rerolls damage against monsters and vehicles.
Correct. I think I found it, Paul.
Okay.
A single fire strike servo turret is 75 points. It's small compared to all the other chassis we've mentioned. It still moves 3 inches somehow.
It's on little floaties.
You stick it in reserve and just walk it on. It is a tiny, minuscule little thing. And the gun's like ain't bad. Like it's got a twin linked auto cannon, or it's got a twin linked las cannon. It's fine.
Yourself.
It's I'm trying here, Betty.
No. I think exactly right. If it checks off all the boxes, then maybe that is, you know, an alternative. That was the point of having the conversation.
Hey, I just saved you like 70. I think I did a win.
That might be it. Maybe that goes into the list. I don't know that it will. Except you now have to go buy
a fire strike servo turret. I've never seen one in the wild. Yeah. I've never seen in the wild.
No, but thinking about this from just a point differential element of it, and that's the next event I'm going to has this differential component to it, the scoring, and those are typically in team tournaments, and I think approaching the scoring a little bit differently than just headlong into a singles 1v1 list is maybe a more appropriate way to do that. And although you do get kind of, you run the risk of getting kind of too bogged down and not seeing the forest for the trees kind of thing. So I figured, well, let's talk about it here and have like a bit of a team therapy session.
Is there some kind of war manual, real-time army dude guy thing about, you know, denying your opponent advantage?
I mean, that's what the whole thing is, right? Every aspect of maneuver is you achieving a position of advantage, and you can achieve positional advantage in all sorts of different ways. It doesn't just have to be physically. And so like having advantage in range does something, right? Having advantage in this way, that way. And then there's a whole thing. I mean, you could argue, and I'm not necessarily recommending you go look it up, but there is like an entire thing called a strategy of denial. That's like a real theory. And so denying people the ability of stuff, right? Like, I mean, we talk about air defense systems and things like that. You could have the best, all these great missiles for whatever it's worth. But if the air defense system is so good that the missiles can't do anything, I'm not going to dip into whatever other things going on. But yeah.
Well, tangentially, there is many records of like Romanesque era battles where they would in the morning rank up, get ready for force distribution, get ready for battle, and then the commanders look at it and be like, "Nah, I don't like today," and they'd pack up, and then they'd move, and then they'd do it again, and it'd be one opponent making the guy who was, you know, trying to defeat them chase them around Greece, Macedonia, right. You know, Gaul, all these things, just being like, not today, man. I'm hungry. It's a bit wet. You know, I don't like the look of them clouds. And then they're off again for the purpose of frustrating and annoying their opponent and stretching supply lines and things like that. Being like, well, if we just keep these guys walking until their console ship is up in T-minus 4 months, they got to go home. So the politics of the day will, you know, win us this war.
Rules, you know, society.
I mean, well, and you could also go to their aspects and strategy of, you know, you take like Napoleon, for example, that like literally taking the field, you had to have an advantage. And there were times where they just, hey, we're not even going to take the because the advantage isn't there. And so they could see that upon approach.
I love the idea of that. I love the idea of like you both, you know, two generals across the way from each other. And the other guy's like, yeah, I don't think he's setting up today. Ah, dang. I was really looking forward to it. they just accept
Wheel these cannons back, you know.
I mean, that would be like, you know, rocking up with nothing but bolt pistols and someone start to bring their, you know, five big knight, Imperial Knights army and being like, yeah, not today. I'll come back tomorrow with my laser cannons.
Give this round to Mulligan. Can we come back?
Yeah. You know, we'll four up this three one. And, yeah, and we'll four up this one for a minor win.
And you kind of got me psyched on this, like hitting on four plus with Overwatch.
I did it. I'm going to sell the first ever Fire Strike Servo turret in the history of humans because I made Paul Murphy. Bang. Gold star Adam.
Look, I'm a big this. Okay, that's not happening. But I don't think it's happening. Let me put it. I don't think it's happening. But I am a big believer of like going and looking at your codex when you need to set, you know, basically check off some stat boxes. Like what fulfills the role that I need to do? Either I need a tool that does something on the tabletop, or I need something that fits within a very niche in the list.
Well, you don't want to be taking something for the purposes of denial that the sole purpose of it is to not be seen, shot, or affect the battlefield in any way.
So you're playing 75 points down or whatever.
Exactly. You want it to add a function, a form and function. You want it to be fit for purpose of some kind rather than just denying your opponent a card off the top of their deck that they may not draw. So yeah, 100%. If you got to find something that's not just like, I mean, there are editions that have gone by where someone had the ability to just take a Rhino, no guns, no tracks, doesn't move, is immobile, no transport capacity. They would have done it. And when that's not the game we play anymore, 100% is not. Everything needs to have a job and be able to do something, to be able to act, score, influence the battlefield. And it's a great place to be.
And that's what I'm thinking. I am teetering between the Ballistus Dreadnought and the Predator Annihilator. For the Predator Annihilator, it can crack Rhinos pretty well. It can crack, heck, it can even shoot a Vindicator from across the table. You know, you can do all kinds of stuff.
So there's 5 points difference between these two chassis, 135 and 140, 135 for the Predator Annihilator. Yeah. It comes with technically two more las cannon shots rather than the two missile shots that the Ballistus has. They both have a very good data sheet ability. One has the rerolls and one just has rerolls. But one is higher toughness with a 2+ save, if I remember correctly. Or are they both toughness 10? I believe they're both might be toughness 10. But the Ballistus I know has a 2+.
That's right.
But then you also have the added duality of having the pseudo fifth las cannon shot in the Hunter Killer missile, which the Ballistus doesn't. So
it's OC4 as well. The Ballistus is OC4 also.
Oh, cool.
For that,
tossing these two things up is actually pretty hard. I think in the meta where we're going to see more knights and blow drones and things like that, I lean on the Predator Annihilator a little bit harder because you never want to shoot and miss against an anti-tank asset. And the fact is that the game is a little bit brutal at the moment, so the 2+ save of the Ballistus doesn't like hold up as much as it does in other metas where, you know, if it can be seen, it can be killed.
And you'll be rolling fives on it most likely or something.
Exactly right. Someone will have like AP3 or AP4 or ignores cover or some nonsense like that. The double down effect is then when you look, so that was just a data sheet comparison, you know, then you gotta zoom out and look through the filter of what detachment I'm taking, what are the utilities I'm taking, what are the buffs and strategies. And strats, you know, available to this package that I'm putting this into. And that
nothing
is,
that works for either one of these very well.
I was about to say, you're playing Blood Angels, right?
Yeah.
So like one half of diddly nothing. So the data sheet needs to be the buy-in. The data sheet needs to be the thing that is worth taking. And for my mind, like, so you got a fourth pseudo fifth las cannon shot versus two las cannon shots plus two worse las cannon shots in the missile.
Missiles, but they could be frags. You know.
Yeah, correct. So, and you have the storm bolters of both ways. So, I got to ask you an important question. In the meta you're playing and the list you're playing, where this is likely to be the only tank that you have, and therefore the first time it shoots, it's going to draw a lot of anti-tank fire. How often is this thing going to shoot? If it's only shooting once, the Predator Annihilator is hands down better, has more shots at a higher value. If you're shooting multiple times and having multiple targets of opportunity, the Ballistus holds up a lot better.
Yeah, I think that it will be in many instances, a single use, you know, fire and forget.
How'd I do, Red? Grade me.
Great. I mean, I don't know, like, in what you're, if it's going to shoot once versus twice thing, you know, statistically, I don't know if you're really gauging the opportunity right. I know, like, what you're saying makes sense, and instinctively your experience as a player balances it out. But Paul, I have to say with full confidence that Adam's sample size of experience is not enough to justify his call.
Where I'm at with all of that aside, you know, what the instincts tells me that Oath of Omen exists. And if I'm shooting at something I think it needs to die, then hitting on threes pretty reliably is going to happen. Maybe I just roll all threes. And look, I've been known to roll some threes, you know, and then cracking when I need to pop a transport to not waste a unit's attack, I'd rather be able to reroll damage. That's kind of where I'm at right now, you know, against everything else. But I don't know what I'm doing with those extra 5 points. So, you know, this may be playing 1995 well, and
they cost the same point with the game we play at the moment and a lack of like significant granularity. If a unit is within 5 points of each other, it's the same point, essentially.
Could be. But I'm looking at play with the ballistas did actually pretty well, able to, you know, kill us some things, you know, with the ballistas dreadnought. But I think you're exactly right, though, that once it comes out to be seen, it just becomes the fire magnet for things that is more premium to shoot at.
If you've only got one tank in your army, and you expose that one tank, essentially every gun that your opponent has that kills tanks now only has the one target they're always going to have. So you're giving them the one thing to shoot their guns at. Yeah, might as well shoot at that, because the las cannon shooting into this jump pack intercessor is like a bad return. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's you know, this thought exercise is what I've been kind of wrestling with the last couple of days, and I think I have come down on the Annihilator. And I almost want to say I hate that because it was suggested by someone that I typically do not agree with list building methodology on.
List building nemesis.
We come about the game, we both great plays and, you know, love them like a brother, but come about it in different ways. And so it's always interesting to hear us talk about list concepts. But in this instance, I think that's, you know, especially when you also think about what you may be paired into, this is, we are kind of talked about in the context of a team event. And, you know, if I'm fighting another melee based army, they might have more transports than I do. And that might be what, you know, makes it more difficult when they can blank two of my turns or something like that.
Yeah. 100%. When you have to trade units for transports, it's bad.
Yeah, it feels like another way. And then, you know, some of those things, well, great, I didn't get it done on the grenades and Hammer of Wrath and the chainsaws just did it. Then you feel it's like even extra bad, like,
oh, yeah,
one other thing. But anyway, I think that's a interesting thing to think about. But it all hinges off of that point denial thing of like, should I even have something like this in the list at all? And I think the answer is yes. And if I'm going to have it, this is what I'd want to have. And this is why, and I feel like pretty much thought of that. And now I want to dovetail into the challenge mechanic. So we watched some games, called some games, and maybe we talked about this on the last episode about the challenge mechanic of how we got to see it being used at an event with people being super competitive. And I don't ever remember it flipping a result of the game. Like, no, I don't know that anyone, and that's very situational, and the sample size, before I even talk about it, incredibly small from what we were looking at. But the deal is that in a event where the differential is arguably more important, potentially more important, you know, do you chase that challenge a little bit more heavily?
Yeah, so there's a lot of things still being learned about challenger cards right now. But one of the first instincts and one of the first, I suppose the negative or the quandary things that I heard when it first came out was that, is this going to result me in doing unoptimum things as far as the game is played in order to generate a challenger card for myself later in the game? For example,
which has always been like the thematic thing that generals sometimes have to wrestle with in their brain with like the maelstrom cards, you realize like, well, when I flip this thing and it makes me run in a different direction, I'm playing ping pong, you know, drunk exactly general right. or whatever.
Yeah. So, I mean, the example that I've heard from people thus far is that, let's say you theoretically draw airy denial and established locus logically. Yep. And you are let's say with the perfect differential down that you got 7 points waiting there in the cards, but if you score all 7 points, you're gonna be under 6 points behind your opponent. And you got the bottom of turn, so you're gonna go straight into your opponent's turn. So you can use one unit to run out into the middle, get 5 points in air denial, and then push the button for 2 points on established locus because they're in the middle of the table. Cool. You've traded one unit and it's gonna get you 7 points. Every day of the week, that's a great unit. That's a great use of any old unit. As long as it doesn't cost the 300 points,
You're talking about five scions or something.
Five scouts, scions, a transport, whatever it is. Now you're much better off. You're much more incentivized in that position specifically to not push the button for the established locus, because that's a 2-point card, and you're giving up the chance to get a 3-point card, pretty much automatically generated and keyed at the start of the next battle round, which is, you know, directly at the end of your turn. And so it makes an unintuitive play pattern where you should want to go out and score both these cards with one unit, but you're disincentivized to because it's a 1-point swing down starting the next battle round. And of course you have the added utility of the fact that every challenger card comes with like a decent stratagem for 0 CP, which could also be used to generate extra value. So what do? You take the points that are face up right in front of you right now, or do you play a little bit, you know, kind of wonky 40K?
You play the game itself, not the mission, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah. Do you choose to play unoptimally, bank that? Also, with added effect that established locus card can become a command point as well, if you haven't got any other way to generate them. So that 2 points is now one command point plus 3 points and the added utility of possibly being a stratagem. So you've essentially turned that one card into 2 CP or 3 points of value. And so it creates these wonky terms and conditions of things. And those are the kind of situations that I've heard people are like, this is a bit, I should want to just score every point that I can, but it's actually not optimum to do so.
Well, okay. I want to argue just slightly to that is that I don't know that,
I mean,
when you're looking at the context of a game, like of just the game itself and looking at all the variables, you know, sometimes that type of like risk versus reward or I'm going to use, you know, with the gamuts, you know, where you would like in a real sense of, do some feints, tactical feints, and maybe, you know, risk a short-term reward for the long-term win type thing. I think that's part of the game. I just don't know that it's part that we've adjusted to it being part of our game right now.
Oh yeah, it's still very early. It's a brand new mechanic, and it's much more impactful than the previous Secret Missions or Gambits. But just as a quick show of hands, who's drawn a Challenger card in one of their games yet, or had one drawn against them?
Just me.
Yeah. What did you think of the mechanic, Tanya?
I think it's fun, but it doesn't often lead to any real change in the pacing of the game. Mm-hmm. I don't find that they usually give you any momentum if you're down or anything like that. It maybe makes you feel like you're still in the game. It makes you feel like you can still score stuff and maybe you still have a chance. But I don't know. Normally the games aren't that close, you know, for it to make that much of a.
That's fair. And yeah, like that speaks to Paul and as experienced commentating, where we saw them drawn, I think, in 4 of the 8 games or so. And yeah, not once did they, I mean, they caused the games to be closer for sure, but not once did they change the outcome.
And that's where I'm thinking in this differential setup. Now we're talking about a very specific match play event style and format or whatever that is not a singles event and, you know, are, you know, very bespoke for this type of team event where differential is the scoring, where the games are not 100 to 50, they're 20 to 0. You know, that's how you it boils down. And so every point that you score gets that tighter. And so you turn games into, you know, 11-9s, you know, I think maybe a little bit easier when you're chasing that. And that's when I think that it is, if you can think in that abstract that we're not used to yet of not scoring that extra 2 points to get you 3 points and a command point later, that maybe turns your 15-5 into a
12-8, 13-7.
Like that for your team score.
Well, I'm of the opinion that we're still like Reg, you literally just said this. We're working with a small sample size as it is right now. But it could be that we just need to literally change those differential, like how close we have to be to be differential. Because right now, if you are 5 points above your opponent in the game, that's an 11-9, and then yada, yada, yada. Maybe we just need to make those smaller because the increments and the differential between people scoring is going to be shorter.
Don't mess up my fourth level chess thinking yet. I'm trying
to win. No. This is the thing we as a community might just have to do down the road. If the challenge mechanic ends up being popular, something people love, people enjoy the mechanic, it makes for more enjoyable games. Because that's what I believe the intent is here. The intent is here that to give people agency when they're getting smashed and they're heavily losing the game to get back into it or to feel like they have more agency and more reasons to continue to play rather than possibly conceding and stuff like that. And so, maybe we just need to it's obvious the challenger mechanic wasn't built in with things like differential scoring.
Not even the remotely thought about it that way. Do I think should it be. But I think the challenger mechanic is great because everything we've described, you get this element of being able to slingshot, you know, potentially back into the game. You've got these extra little things to decide on, which are sometimes cool when you decide and it works out favorably for you. And you got a free stratagem to use that, you know, could just be a cool effect.
Yeah. So funnily enough, if the challenger mechanic becomes something that people really, really love and it's, you know, only a positive for the game, I'd love for a second rider to be added there. So if you're six points or more down, you get to do either the strat or the points. And if you're like 20 or more points down, you do both. You just do both.
That would be fun. And I feel like that would actually make it feel a little bit more impactful on the game.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. I think that would be not broken. I mean, you're 20 points down. This 3 points and going through a wall or advancing and shooting ain't going to make up 20 points of value. But, you know, it could give somebody, you know, a hell of a lot more fun and be like, well, you know what, I'm going to go down this game, but your warlord, he's dead. He's so freaking dead and I'm going to get him and that kind of stuff. I love it.
I like the mechanic a lot. I really do. And I think this is built for, you know, those individual games to where the consequence of those games, you know, are decided at the end of that turn five, you know, kind of thing. But, you know, anyway, just thinking about this from this aspect as this is the event that I've been preparing for. And I did play a couple of games over the weekend, Blood Angels versus Death Guard, and was, you know, prepared to be hacked up with size right off the table, was able to kind of hold my own, which is cool. You know, start to play that trading game. And the list that I built, and I can post it in the show notes, has a bunch of trading units, like a 14 scoring units, and the ones that matter, fight first or fight on death. And if I had remembered to scout backwards, which we'll talk about this after the break, would have saved a lot of scouts. A lot of scouts perished needlessly over the course of the weekend.
Many Buffins died.
I mean, I was really focused on keeping the Death Guard away from me, you know, kind of thing. And that seemed to work out okay. But once you have board control, you know, even somewhere else, having units on the table to score points is good too, which is what we're talking, going back to the challenge mechanic. Actually, let's take a quick break. Then we'll come back, talk a little bit more about the challenge mechanic, and then like this whole idea of trading it. See you in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
We are back, everyone. Please, please, please check out our sponsors. There are so many things that are coming up for pre-order, and I know folks are like having to jump the gun or send on a website or hope they get it or whatever. If you contact Discount Games, Jay over there, about pre-orders, secure your place if something's very important to you. So don't be shy about reaching out, and our sponsors have been this for a long time and absolutely love working with them. And they have systems that you can participate with to get stuff that you want. We were talking about, well, we're kind of specifically, but like the challenger mechanic and list building for an event where there is a scoring differential is how you come to see who wins the game or not. And it got me thinking about like, what situation would you have to hopefully engineer if you found yourself being the challenger to maximize being the challenger? Now, I mean, obviously you want to flip to, if you're playing tactical objectives, you want to flip to things that are achievable to you, you know, but there's like, what, in what conditions are you more likely to achieve those things or anything, not just those things, anything, and then score the 3 points as well. You know, or can you foresee maybe yourself being down before the game, before the first dice are even rolled?
So there it's very interesting thought exercise you just pointed out there. So there, we all know fixed is something that's face up that your opponent can play around, your opponent can mess with your ability to score, but you're actually kind of incentivizing them to not do that. Let's say you take two medium scoring fixed objectives, one of which, you know, probably resolves in killing something, which your opponent can throttle by not letting you have XYZ opportunities, and the other one by having a positional behind him, both of which your opponent can mess with. But if they mess with it, you're drawing challenger cards, which essentially come out as medium scoring secondaries off the top of the deck equivalents, and come with positional advantage stratagems attached to them, things that allow you to, you know, advance and shoot, have rerolls, things like that. So you're actually pointing out a very interesting conundrum there, where if somebody does give up a reasonable amount of fixed secondaries and you can take one that is decent for that and then one is positionally okay, your opponent's like, well, if I throttle all of these, am I actually stopping them from scoring? I'm not. I'm just letting them generate a bunch of extra, you know, medium level points early in the game. And then, you know, when things get rolling, it's a lot harder to deny those things like behind enemy lines, those things like assassinate, etc. You know, because of course everyone's best units have characters attached to them. And are you winning a game without using all of your best units? Probably not.
It could be like 400 points for, you know, for these models that you might not, that you're not trying not to put out in harm's way. That's a big chunk of points.
It is. So you're actually posing a pretty interesting question there, a pretty interesting question to them. It's like, is it worth trying to stop me scoring my fixed secondaries if I'm just going to score points or challenger cards anyway? And then towards the back end of the game, you know, when things start to get really rolling and we're in each other's grills, I'm still going to get a bunch of these points anyway. So actually, yeah, I actually quite like that. It's specific builds and stuff like that, I think, is very, very good. But spicy.
I mean, your opponent may present themselves, you know, I mean, maybe you just know that you're weak into one list or the other, you know, and that way you think about it in a way as like, well, crap, if I take this route, I might score fewer, but it opens this up. And since I'm going to engage less, so it got me thinking, if I engage less in some of these other things, then I may have more pieces available to take advantage of big scoring turns when I'm in the challenger way. And then instead of being down by six, now I'm up by three. And, you know, depending on what turn the game that is, who went first, who went second, that could be a million. Not in differential game, but it's the game in general, whether or not you come out squeak across the finish line in a photo finish.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very fascinating thinking exercise there. And of course, this is kind of the thing you wouldn't build into a list, but it'd be more of a play to hold in the top of your head should you come into a matchup where it's just an obvious kind of advantage to do so.
I could be on that. Yeah. I can imagine being on the sidelines. He went fixed. Oh my God.
Yeah. So that hasn't happened yet, has it? We haven't called game in gosh diggity darn year where someone's taken fixed objectives.
No.
I'm
wondering if, you know, people even remember that they can do that.
Well, everyone is so incentivized to play these. I guess talking outside teams, the game has super incentivized you to play a pretty well balanced list.
Well, and like containment existed, you know, 3 weeks ago too. I mean, that's a big point of a lot of points.
Yeah. Yeah. Ain't no fix that's given you the value that containment's given you. Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this edition
was given. It's gone now. So I'm like, this is like, do we think differently about this type of stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, you're super incentivized to take like an all comers list now. There is no one skew to rule them all. People are talking about, you know, Death Guard sitting at a, you know, a pretty high skew, but they're not actually a skewed list. They just sit at unique breakpoints for the chassis that they take or just that they have. I suppose the case in point, Paul's playing show and tell. But the, you know, the Knights is kind of the skew list by default. Things like Custodes are also the kind of the skew list by default. Yeah, having a great. Anybody else got any show and tell? Come on, let's go.
Okay, if you're listening to us on the podcast aggregators, I'm showing off two vetted bloat drones with grenade launchers because they are very good. And as mentioned before, and I just these, I don't know, I got a good Death Guard scheme. I think it goes together pretty.
I have a Rogaldorn. It's not finished yet, though. And for some reason, Adam has a wrench.
And
I'm not trying to segue us from the multiple wrenches from this, but I'm talking about break points with the Death Guard, and you know, this is one of those things that might break folks.
Question, maybe just a little chitty chat question. With the popularity of Death Guard and things like Knights, things like Custodes, what is the easiest army to paint? That looks good. Yeah. See, there's even more ones I didn't say. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
Necrons are terrible to put together. So
it's correct.
If you have a recipe, things get a little easier to do.
I mean, some Astartes schemes are extremely easy. Do you have a black Astartes scheme? You're good.
Oh, if you learn to play black well, you're kind of ahead of the game.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I actually think black is my hardest color to paint and make it look good. Yeah.
I think Necrons is the easiest to paint because you really can. And I'm not saying that that people take it and don't go to the extreme with it. You see beautiful painted Necron armies. Yeah. But like if you just had a sprayed lead belcher and then washed with basically any of the washes, you've got a passable Necron army.
I mean, if you want, dry brush with the silver and pick out the details. Yeah. Like,
and
the
you weapons, guys are making this way more difficult than it needs to be. You just prime it black, and then you dry brush it silver.
Fair.
You gotta
done. Right,
wrecked.
That's right.
Yeah.
And your weapon's already base coated. You bring out the weapon. I don't want to get us too far off the marker for the conversation though, because we were talking about breakpoints of Death Guard, and I think you've given some good points of like, you know, how to conceptualize how you approach the missions with the current meta that's out there. I think that's what you were talking about.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to consider at them, and there are some armies that are innately better at some aspects of the game than others. I mean, if Assassinate's still a fixed, right? I'm not tripping. Which one did they remove?
Yeah.
Did they remove Bring It Down as a fixed? I think they moved. They removed either Assassinate or Bring It Down as a fixed.
No Prisoners is no longer a...
That's it.
You got me second guessing myself because I'm like...
Me too. I remember they removed one in the match play mission pack.
A lot of additions appear. Yeah,
because it was just like doomsday for people, you know, taking multiple character support units and stuff like that. People just take No Prisoners and Assassinate and like, lol, game over. But yeah, I think there's a lot conceptually to think of here when establishing, you know, what is your player pattern, how you want to approach certain armies and certain missions, certain games. Also, I will say I do think it was a good call by them to drop the bonus mission stuff or the bonus special rules to different things, like they did in the latest one, where it's just literally okay, here's the mission. There it is. It's the one page. It's the mission. That's it. That's what you're playing. There's no extra spice.
Battle line means nothing. Get rid of battle lines. Yeah.
That is an interesting thing that they did there, where they super incentivized us in the previous pack, or was it the previous two packs, to take battle line in order to score effectively. Do we feel like that was a good choice, getting rid of the battle line, you know, incentives?
Well, battle line, now it matters for your armyless construction. Like, if it kind of lets you know what you can take more of, and if that's important to you, then you take something that's like that. And I don't mind that. I think playing with what is battle line.
It's a different approach. I admit I enjoyed the battle line mission mechanics because it made things as you built them matter. But I don't think that the way that they've changed it is necessarily better or worse. It's just a different way to approach it. And again, I don't think that it drastically shifted to such an extent that it's like, it makes or breaks it.
But you know, it's one of those to where now whether or not it matters is in your detachment, you know, I got, or maybe in your base.
Right, right. It goes into list construction in a different way. Right.
But are there enough battle lines and differences in the battle line? I know we could talk about this. It's probably a topic for a different show. If it stays that way. But I don't mind it being a lever to pull. You know, like these are things that help keep the game interesting. Like if you're playing the same old missions against, let's say you're not going anywhere and playing. You're playing against your one buddy. You know, whatever. This does give you a different play experience today than it was yesterday.
Yeah, I personally was a big fan of the battle line incentives, and I thought they didn't go far enough to Red's point. I don't think what they did, you know, shook the meters or, you know, changed the scoring dynamics enough. I wanted them to push it even further. In fact, I just want some blanket battle line rules. Like, okay, if you are battle line, not battle shock, plus one OC. Let's make them all three. Let's go. Let's actually push it. And stuff like that. I think it was a clever thing to do at the time. Either they didn't follow through with it enough, or they thought like this was too uneven as it was. Because right now, not all battle line units are created equal.
That's actually never been the case. That was one of my I'm really segueing this, and I apologize. But you know, going back thinking about comp, is everything should be comped, and you know, like there's a comp score how your army was. It's like, well, my guardians are not the same as your tac marines, like that.
yeah and I like 100%, like I mean, you compare a plague marine or a rubric marine and what that unit can do and the potential of that unit versus, you know, a unit of guardsmen, and despite that, a guardsman is still one of the best battle lines in the game because of its flexibility. But you look at the damage output, durability and flexibility of a unit of plague marines that can shoot, fight, and be durable, hold down whole flanks by themselves, and then you got little Bubby with his flashlight. He's like, I'm going to get that kind of fix. You know, it's just, these are apples and oranges. But I do like overarching ways to incentivize more of this. And that's essentially what they are doing with the battle line changes.
No, curious to see where they go with that, if they continue to pull that lever through different iterations. But anyway, I'm looking forward to it. And I really do like this new mission pack. I think the challenge mechanic, going back to that, is enough of a carrot like it's like a cool incentive thing where everyone will get to experience it, and it is the least obtrusive to the play experience of the mechanics we've seen so far with that, yeah, with that intent.
So the issue with the gambit is, and the gambit mechanic that I found when I tried to play them, was that it took you away from playing a linear game to try and get closer. You had to abandon pretty much all other logical lines of play in the hopes of scoring a bunch of points at the end of the game. So you had to jump off your objectives, you know, rush into the middle of the table, leaving behind points here, there, and everywhere, in order to, fingers crossed, hope your opponent doesn't realize what you're doing and stop you. Or the secret mission mechanic, which in some ways was very busted when you could still score on turn 5 primary and then score your secret mission. Then when that was taken away, kind of lost a lot of juice. And so there was armies that could do it very freely and armies that really didn't have the option. I'm talking about like Thousand Suns once again. Magnus triple moves, takes your home objective on turn 5, lol, 20 points. There's not much you can do about it.
Magnus is alive at the end of the game, you know.
That's right. That's it. But I mean, if they're just going to use Magnus and just be like, well, Magnus is good for 20 points, sometimes you're okay with that. Like, oh, cool. Magnus is like a game-winning model. And if you're just going to hold him at the back of the board for 20 points at the end, I can live with that. You know, I can turn that to advantage. And so, yeah, there was that. That was, but I think this one's even better.
Yeah.
I think this one's even better because it is an incremental thing. So turn by turn, you become the challenger and lose the challenger, become the challenger. And of course, I do think it's more likely that as soon as you are the person who is the challenger, you're like, unless you draw the absolute nuts off the top of the deck and draw like 12 points where the secondaries, and then the freaking, I'm not sure you get 12 points of secondaries outside, like, yeah, I don't know if I'm sure you can. And then the secondary, the challenger cards as well. Because once they took, so... Yeah, I'm trying to figure out if they can as well, because I don't think there's any. I don't think there's multiple 6+ scoring cards anymore. Because Bring It Down caps at a single use of a single instance now, and Containment's gone. So I don't think there is any like 6+ point scoring cards anymore. So 13 is the best you're going to swing, essentially, or you know that's the best. That's the bee's knees turn. And with that being the case, 13. Let's say you're 6 points up. Your opponent scores no points in their turn, and you score 13. They're the challenger. If they do an absolute diggity donut, you know,
that sounds like a fun time though.
Fun battle round. That's a very fun battle round. Yeah.
Looking at this with the battle line, like list design, that's also something that factors into it. It's like, how many battle line troops do I need? Like, I think now I want a couple of units that might be OC2, you know, that I don't mind kind of maybe not really engaging in the battle or causing a problem for my opponents. But I don't feel like I need quite as many because I'm not having to raise those banners at least once during the tournament.
Yeah, exactly right. And that's the thing, when they've dropped off some of those extra mechanics and now they've actually made some of the ones that remained score a little bit worse, like Terraform. Terraform used to be 2 points, now it's 1 point. You're a little bit disincentivized to take units specifically for that purpose. If anything, they're pushing us a little bit more to just like min-maxing a little.
Yeah, I don't mind that. I mean, I'm not saying this is a bad thing at all. Like, if I can take something that's a little bit more exciting or something that's been sitting on the shelf a little bit because I felt like I had to take something else. I like mixing up. I am a proponent of these types of changes when they occur in the game. You know, let me also kind of hedge that a bit. Is like I have a deep collection to where I'm less rattled when I have to change or less disrupted.
Roll with it.
But I do like it because it does. Like the game plays a lot differently than it did before, and I was enjoying that. And if I was feeling stale, this feels better. And I do happen to also coincidentally think that this challenger mechanic is the best one of these catch up mechanics that we've had so far.
Yeah, I agree.
So do you take any unit specifically for these challenger cards? Because so far I found that Gaunt's Ghost is like my best unit for taking advantage of these challenger cards.
That's a good question. I don't think I have enough games yet to think that, man, if I just had this one thing.
So Tanya's onto it actually, because let's just say you spread out all your challenger cards in front of you, you'll find the vast majority of them are triggered off positional advantages, positional things like doing an action here, there, everywhere. And so Gaunt's Ghost is the fact that it can like do orders and do actions. There's nothing to say you can't order and action. It's like generating a double down effect of points scoring and generating value. So like I didn't even think of that, but Gaunt's Ghost probably S tier challenger generator.
And in this corner, gaunt.
I know they're expensive. I know they're expensive, but man, they always put in work for me. I think I'll always break
off. If they're expensive, but they do all the, if they like, they score the points. I mean,
I don't think they are expensive. I think they're accurately costed, and that really annoys guard players.
guard is Red all about the value town.
Red looks like he has feelings about this.
I mean, I think that for all the units from all the books that have held on, you know, thank you, whatever thing is out there, karma, whatever you want to call it, that's kept Gaunt's Ghost on the field. Because, and I'm glad that they're cost effective. They have great rules, and they just rock it out. And I'm glad to see them still making their way onto the table because they're utility effective. You know, they're not like the command kind of unit that they were when they first kind of came out, but I think that they've really found a good spot for them, and I'm glad to see them still rolling on the table because not everybody got that treatment. So be grateful for it.
Also, is this the only Black Library unit that is not Legends?
No. I mean, they've got more new ones now, right? Like the I can't remember.
I don't know. Can you? You can't take like the Hell's Nine Hell's or Last, whatever.
Hell's Last are Legends. Severina Reign is Legends. Like, I don't know about the other factions, but like all the guard things are Legends except for Gaunt's Ghost.
I mean, isn't Ursula Creed? She's in a book, right?
But I don't. I think
she came out in a codex first.
Specifically,
yeah, that's fair. There's a Leontis book. That's simple. You're right.
No, I think specifically created from a Black Library book before they were ever a model rule in a book or whatever.
Because technically that'd be all the chaos, everything. You know, but 100%, 100%. You're actually
no, fine. We can find a Space Marine. Easy. What's his name? Uriel Ventress. Perfect.
Found Never him. Heard of him. Never heard of him.
Yeah,
got exactly. A silly haircut.
Is the worst haircut.
I don't know. Kayvan Shrike has a pretty bad haircut.
Oh,
bunch of emo
just
people.
Watch
just
it.
You lost some viewers.
Oh yeah, I forgot. Paul was a scene kid.
That could be a tier list. We do a tier list of worst haircuts in.
The Sisters of Battle old models have some really bad haircuts.
Get down in the comments and let us know what is the worst haircut of the model in the 44.0 on them.
The follow up tier list, the best hat.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Can't be a helmet, has to be a hat.
Yeah. I think that's our show this week. It's been, you know, I guess the loose theme of this is like list design for mission, alternate mission formats. And this is, I know we talked about specifically about some lists, but then we talked conceptually about the objectives and how to, you know, maybe interact with them or approach the game of, if you feel like you're going to be down anyway, and how to maximize the challenge mechanic. And it really is a neat thing. And the, like, is anyone, if anyone has more experience with it, let us know how you're engaging with it and where what's working for you. And Titania, that was a great question. Is like, is there a unit in your codex, and I mean anybody's codex, that is your back pocket, like this is my ace in the hole, if I'm down, this is the unit that digs me out?
Well, that's exactly right, because to Tanya's point, the worst position you could be in is you're drawing dud secondaries, so you're the challenger, and then you draw a challenger card you can't score, and then you're like, well,
yeah,
what am I doing? Yeah.
Oh, but thanks a lot for hanging out. It's been a pleasure talking with y'all. We'll be back next week. Y'all, please don't forget to like, share, subscribe, leave those 5-star reviews. I mentioned, like, leave some 5-star reviews. I'll read them out on air with the caveat of within reason, of course, you know. But looking forward to it. We'll see y'all next time, everybody. Have a great night.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
See ya.
What they said, but I already subscribed. You better do it too.